Hi, Natasha Mitchell on ABC Radio National, on air and online at abc.net.au/rn. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been in Australia this week, in the year that of course marks the 20th anniversary of his Nobel Peace Prize and 50 years since his exile from China. And as well as meeting with a new incarnation of sorts, the Liberal leader Tony Abbott, the Dalai Lama also joined me on the stage at the Mind and Its Potential Conference for an extended dialogue this week. So today, join us in that conversation, which really continues the decades of exchange that the Dalai Lama has fostered with scientists. Sharing the stage was leading psychologist and founder of the field of positive psychology, Martin Seligman, Harvard evolutionary biologist and psychologist, Mark Hauser, and Buddhist and meditation scholar, Alan Wallace. So right throughout this month, I'll be bringing you their shared conversations here on All in the Mind. Let's start then with His Holiness the Dalai Lama as he enters the stage with his translator, the Buddhist scholar Geshe Dorji Dumdul. Thank you, Your Holiness. I remember reading for you as a nine-year-old boy, and we've seen those pictures of you as a nine-year-old boy, your first lesson in Buddhist psychology was to learn that the definition of mental, of the mental, is that which is luminous and knowing.
Yes.
And 65 years later, are you any clearer about what that means and what it could mean for the rest of us?
Naturally. When I start learning these mind or the sub-mind, or I don't know, you see, different variety of consciousness or mind. No enthusiasm. no interest to learn. then gradually, of course, more serious interest. Then particularly, I think last few decades when we engage, I think biologists also, I think, some of these sort of emotions is a biological factor. So very much related with that. And also the human being and other animals also is common. And then of course brain, our human brain is something very special. As a result, the thinking, the power of thinking is much, much greater. So then sometimes I feel, we also need more divisions in Buddhist text. Almost, I think, 2,000 years. Till recently, the scripture mentioned that. Now, with help of scientists who also, you see, study about emotion, these different things, I feel it's very helpful to enrich our traditional sort of knowledge.
What does it mean to say that the mind or the mental is luminous and knowing?
It's not a physical, no form. I think implication is formless, but something very clear, many things can reflect on it, and through that way, knowing. So it is very basic nature is knowing. I think knowing. And after knows, then feeling. I think that's the meaning.
I understand on your desk in Dharamsala, there is a plastic brain given to you, a model of a brain given to you by the late Robert Livingston, your friend and scientist. And I guess science is very keen to define what it's talking about. And some would say that the mind is the 100 billion neurons in that brain, 100 billion brain cells. Or they would say that the mind is a machine. Some would say that it is a computer. But how do you visualize the mind?
Sure. Now here we have to make distinction. The grosser level of mind, or more subtle and more subtle. The grosser level of mind, of course, a product of brain or neuron. There's no question. But then more deeper, more subtler. Now, for example, we now already begin investigation. Person who clinically dead. So that means brain dead. But still, there is something inside. Indication that dead body still remain very fresh. Sometimes 3 weeks, 4 weeks remain like that. It's not everybody, but those people who have some experience about meditation. I think last 50 years in India, as far as I notice, 20.
20 some, people.
20 people. So we have to find explanation how it happened.
So you're observing, you're sensing the continuation of mind. I wonder how science could investigate that.
So then scientists showing very, very keen interest, and they make available some simple mission to examine that person who supposed some subtle mind still in the body. Some short electric...
Oh, so they put an electroencephalogram on the head, measuring brain waves.
You see, few days after death, it is impossible, but it happened.
Tricky.
So, you see, actually, you see, dead body remain fresh about 3 weeks. I mean, the scientific way, not yet is a find explanation. And this is the subject to further investigation. From the ancient Indian sort of psychology, then the subtle mind, which is more independent from this body. So that mind still in the body. So grosser level mind, dead. But subtle mind, still remain there in that dead body, like that. As soon as you see that mind depart from the body, then immediately, within minute, body decay, and some smell, and some liquid come. That always happens. So this is one field, sort of further investigation, jointly, the Buddhist sort of psychology sort of explanation, and modern scientists with this equipment, then things may become clearer. But in any way, worthwhile to investigate.
You pose an incredible challenge to science. But I know in recent years, there's been, as you would know very well, there's been tremendous interest in the plasticity of our brain. It's a very hopeful view of the brain. I think the science is still very much being developed. But you would argue, I know, that Buddhism has long held a philosophy that and an understanding of the plasticity of the brain. Can you explain that, the Buddhist interpretation of plasticity, and how that links with what you have read and understood about the neuroscience of plasticity, that our brain can change in response to behaviours or environment, input, therapy, education?
As a result of a new experiment, like Dr. Khaza, Richard Davidson, they, through sheer sort of meditation, so that means just sort of mental activities, that actually can change brain. Now they begin to see through just the sheer sort of mental work.
Yes.
Some change in the brain. I think you should explain. You see, through meditation.
And this is Richard Davidson's work, isn't it?
Yes.
So he's working with meditators and observing what happens in their brain after they do a course of meditation. Alan Wallace.
Sure, I'd be very brief, but there was a very well-known study that he published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science a few years ago. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin had a fair number of monks from Bhutan, Tibet primarily, as I recall, who had meditated anywhere between 10,000 and 60,000 hours. So these were truly highly trained, very professional meditators. And what they found is that as a result of, it seemed, correlated with their meditative experience was increased activity in the left prefrontal cortex, which Richard Davidson and other neuroscientists believe is correlated with positive affect, feeling good. And it was really quite exceptionally well developed, and it was more developed among meditators who had meditated 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, as opposed to 10 or 20. So it seemed to be correlated with the extent of the meditative practice. That was one major finding, and another one was exceptional increase in gamma. And so this is an EEG measurement, a certain frequency of the electromagnetic field generated by the brain, and that too was really very exceptional. Exactly what that means is difficult to sort out, but what was quite unequivocally demonstrated in this study is that years and years of very intensive meditation do clearly have a measurable impact on the brain. So more is to be seen, and longitudinal studies clearly need to be done.
Absolutely. You know, I guess we've focused too, I'm rather interested in this question of, we've focused very much on individual brains and the plasticity of individual brains, measuring the positive outcomes for individuals. And I wonder if there might be scope for a collaboration between Buddhism and psychology to work out how we might measure the social plasticity of brains, the ability of how individual minds might effectively collaborate. Because it seems to me that we can understand individual brains, but do we not want to better understand how brains work together to respond to climate change, for example, or war? I wonder if that's that would be an interesting project for Buddhism and psychology.
Collective psychology. I don't know.
It's too big a question. I think that's a good answer.
Sometimes the people use the word, some dialogue between Buddhism and modern science. So then I feel it may create confusion. So more precise, I don't know the exact word, but according to my own limited vocabulary, I usually make like this, Buddhist science, and then Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist concept. Then Buddhist religion, three parts. So, discussing with modern scientists, nothing to do with the Buddhist religion, nor, I think, basically, not Buddhist concept. Some Buddhist views, like the relativity, absence of absolute or independence, these involve, but basically, simply Buddhist science. That means in Buddhism, you see, there's a lot of explanation about mind, because the Buddhist method or way of approach is training mind. Through training of mind, change our mind, transformation of our emotion. That's the way, not through sort of some kind of blessing from outside, but within ourselves. Change. So therefore, the mind is something very important of the matter. So therefore, we should have full knowledge about that. So the Buddhist psychology, in the Buddhist science, although the matters, or sometimes some Buddhist literature, you see, mentioned this, the world geography in center Mount Meru, that out of dated. I do not believe. At least for this planet. And some other planet, who knows? So Buddhists, you see, actually, you see, touch these things. But these, nothing to do with religion, but simply mentioned about the, what is it, the, how's that mean, it's just, cosmology. And how to start this whole universe. These also is a touch. Five elements, like that. So that's Buddhist science. So we are discussing with modern scientists about modern science and Buddhist science. So this is nothing to do with some discussion about whether there's next life on these things, or salvation on these things, or God, and nothing to do. There's something different level, like that. So, that I want to make clear. Buddhist science, not Buddhism.
Excellent. Let's look at how Buddhist science views emotion. This has been a very interesting partnership between you in your dialogue with scientists. And to conceive that Buddhist science considers that there are 84,000 negative emotions is unimaginable to me. And I guess your great quest is to help us relieve ourselves of negative or destructive emotions like craving, hostility, delusion. And it still makes me wonder why those hostile emotions, those destructive emotions, if they are so bad for us, why do they persist? Why are they so pervasive? Destructive emotions seem to be essentially human, and I wonder if that means they have a purpose.
I believe these different emotions, each emotion, I think on biological level, some purpose. Anger, fear, is for one's own survival, bring facility for survival. Anger, hatred, expel a negative factor and brings more effort. A jealousy, also in order to survive, sometimes jealousy also necessary. So that's a fact. Some scientist once told me, anger, the blood circulation more on arms in order to fight. And the fear develop, and then blood circulation goes more on leg, ready to run away. So you see, there is a close connection. Emotions and biological, certain sort of mental sort of activities and physical, very close. So these negative, some emotions, these emotions are very much related with biological factor, mainly for survival and reproduction and defense. Then another level. Now, this moment, we can't say this emotion is destructive, this emotion is constructive. We can't say that. Animals also have same. Now, we human being, because of this intelligence, so we have the ability to think long-term interest, not just temporary survival. So then in terms of long-term sort of interest, then some of these emotion is actually no benefit, in fact, harmful. Some emotion useful. Then the concept destructive emotion, constructive emotion, then develop according to the long-term interest. So basically in Buddhism, long-term in the sense, firstly, Buddhism explaining the possibility of elimination some of these emotions. Emotion which ultimately based on ignorance, that is possible to remove because it based on ignorance. More enlightened way, enlightened view developed, that sometimes we call wisdom, also knowledge or awareness which knows the reality. That is based on valid way, valid mind. So valid mind, ignorance, contradiction each other. Therefore, valid mind train or increasing the ignorance or the opposite, just opposite sort of, direct opposite ignorance can reduce. That's the Buddhist sort of philosophy. Not only philosophy, but that is Buddhist concept, Buddhist approach. So then, now there is certain goal, certain sort of purpose or certain ultimate goal. According to that, among these emotions, biological factors, emotion, some are useful to achieve that. And we can further strengthening. But some emotion is no use for that goal. And not only that, if we think more deeper way, those emotions which based on ignorance is ultimately bring some discomfort or disaster, such as anger. For immediate, anger is useful to defend. But anger creates some kind of blindness, too much anger, we can't see the reality. Similarly, too much attachment there, you can't see the reality. In order to see the reality, our mind should be very calm and unbiased. Through unbiased mental state, you can see objectively. We can look objectively. Then you can see the reality. So if it is like animal, just day-to-day life, feeding, shelter, sex, no sort of words a day, not much relevant destructive emotion or constructive emotion. We human beings, with this intelligence, long-term interest, then, you see, some emotions are useful, some emotions are very negative. Therefore, now the demarcation, destructive emotion and positive emotion.
So like how would you view an experience like depression? You know, the emphasis now is very much on investigating depression and its biochemical causes so that people can develop biochemical treatments. And so in the context of this conversation about destructive emotion, how do you view depression?
Actually, in Buddhist psychology, exact term depression. So I think we have to find a new terminology. So depression, as far as I know, I think we can't divine. Depression is
in fact, as for depression, we cannot classify depression as one solid mental state because it has various kinds.
Due to main causes and conditions, some depression, you see, due to this cause, or that sort of condition. And this similar sort of level of depression, but essentially different cause. So therefore, I think treatment should deal with the real causes of that depression. Depression is something like symptom. So like illness, some pains here. Just we say, oh, I have this pain and some drugs to remove. It's not sufficient. This pain, what is the causes? And then dealing with that causes, then this pain relief. So similarly, depression, mental illness, different causes. So we have to deal with causes of depression. So there may be, I think, a variety.
Your Holiness, in your book, Ancient Wisdom, Modern World, you called for a radical reorientation from our habitual preoccupation with a self, especially in the West. And I wonder if you see a risk with the huge increase in interest in meditation, whether in the West we might risk an increase in that focus on the self rather than an outward focus.
No, that is. Now, whether accept religion or not, it is quite obvious. Those individuals who always think just oneself and don't care about others' well-being, and even to some extent, they exploit on other in order to fulfill one's own interest, or bully on other. So all these murders, thief, sexual abuse, and then telling lies, deceiving, all these ultimately self-centered, extreme self-centered egoistic. So someone who sort of indulge killing, we cannot stop or don't do killing. But we have to deal the motivation level. And then that action can stop. Something change at the motivation level. So therefore, I think the West, the Judeo-Christian background, culture, or now like Christianity or Islam or many other religion or Judaism, I think the emphasis faith Even in order to increase faith, the concept of creator happened. So the total faith towards creator, that means total submission to God. So that actually same effect, self-centered, strong ego. Isn't it? I'm just creation, part of creation of God, and totally submit to God. So Buddhism say another way, there is no independent self, selflessness. So two way of approach, reduce, extreme self-centered egoism. So I think that's common everywhere. I think one family, say, I think five people in the family, someone who always think just himself or herself, don't care about the rest of the four families. And I think eventually that family create more trouble. Five people in the family always have the spirit of sharing each other. Then that family much happier. Even dogs, some individual dogs always fight. Then he or she always remain lonely. One dog is friendly. Every other dogs then always remain very peaceful, asleep, like that. So that's a fact.
Which makes me wonder if this, you know, meditation has taken the West by storm. People are very interested in it, and yet many are practicing it separate from Buddhist philosophy. And I wonder whether when you separate the two like that, there is a risk that meditation makes people more self-centered, more self-obsessed, without that context.
I think meditation, historically, in India, meditation is common. Buddhism, non-Buddhism. Even if it's samatha, vipassana, both common. Buddhist, non-Buddhist. So some other sort of philosophical viewpoint or certain sort of motivation, then due to these factors, then meditation or vipassana or samatha make differences. Otherwise, same. So today, meditation, in the sense, training of mind, is related with everybody, whether believer or non-believer. Even those people who are very much sort of against religion, if they, through training, their sort of method to control religion becoming more effective, so better. Like that. Even I think the cruel person concentration
can benefit.
Develop sharp mind. And then also the one Buddhist concept, interdependency, concept of interdependency, that gives them more holistic. Mm. So their destructive action become much more effective.
Okay. Always laughing. Definitely some challenges in there for us too. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and you also heard briefly from Buddhist scholar Alan Wallace, president of the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, and whose latest book is called Mind in the Balance. We'll hear more from him in coming weeks. As ever, you'll find the audio and transcript on the All in the Mind website, which is where you can discuss the show directly on the webpage now, by the way, as well as my blog. Just look for Add Your Comment, all at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Next week, the dialogue continues. The founder of the field of positive psychology and author of Learned Optimism and also Authentic Happiness, Martin Seligman, will join the discussion with the Dalai Lama. Look forward to your company then. Hope it's a good week for you as you hurtle headfirst into the silly season. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks to sound engineer Jenny Parsonage. Bye for now.